Okay, I'll just get started with some information I think that's necessary. And I'll explain my background and why I think it's necessary. And anytime you want to interrupt me, please do so. Because I'm going to talk a lot at first about the legal nature. Is everyone in who's coming in? When we talk about ethics, the term ethics implies moral standards of behavior that conforms to the standards of a profession. Usually, these ethics are set by members of the profession themselves. For example, the AMA, the APA, and for professional pastoral counselors, the AAPC. 99% of pastors do not belong to the AAPC. And then when we're talking about ethics, usually we're talking just about Christian ethics. And since Christian ethics are one thing and legal knowledge is another thing, I'm going to spend quite a bit of time on legal knowledge. When any of you go through the entire system in the Missouri Synod, starting with high school, three poor guys, okay. I did, and I want to explain why I think this legal talk is necessary. When I went to the seminary, you weren't even allowed to be married until vicarage, I think. And after going through an all-male school for 12 years, I came out 5 years socially retarded. Not only was I socially retarded, but I didn't know that much about the world. Didn't know that much about the legal nature of things and how pastors need to know things about their profession that come from disciplines other than theology. And when you're a pastor, law is one of them. So I'm going to talk about ethics and confidentiality in terms of the law, first of all. Confidentiality implies trust that a person places in you that you will not reveal private or secret matters. We're talking about trust. And ethics and confidentiality are really all part of the same pastoral relationship. How many of you are acquainted with the way pastoral care and pastoral counseling relationships are distinguished from each other? Okay, I'll explain it then. Pastoral care relationship is something that you do as a pastor every day, something that you are expected to do as a member of your profession. A pastoral counseling relationship is when a person or persons come to you to set aside time to discuss something very specific that may bother them and for which they're seeking help. Pastoral care relationship, you know, you see people, you initiate conversation with a family when a child is born, when a person's in the hospital. That's pastoral care relationship. Pastoral counseling relationship is a legal technicality. But it exists more than you think it does. How many of you have heard the term privileged communication? Okay, or confessional seal. How many of you are aware that it does not exist? Okay, it does not exist. Privileged communication or confessional seal is a myth that whatever a person says to you, even under the guise of confession, is covered by law. There is no such thing as privileged communication for clergy, for social workers, for medical doctors, for psychologists, for any professional counselor. It applies only to the lawyer-client relationship. And it's necessary to remember that. I'm going to say, I'm going to say a number of things that scare you, and I really don't mean to, but I want you to know what the legal nature of being a pastor is, okay? It's nothing to be scared about, but it's good to have the knowledge. Okay. Also, I want to say that the legal nature of a relationship is the same whether it's an individual or a family, so I'll talk mostly in the singular, but it applies across the board usually. The legal nature of a pastoral relationship is called a contract. And a contract is in effect whenever two people enter into a kind of relationship where one is delivering service to another. So usually you are the one delivering the service. And even if the contract is not stated legally, it is implied legally. And the contract begins whenever you take information from another person. For example, be after Bible class, after an evening meeting at the church, somebody just comes up and, "Hey, Pastor, I know it's 10:30 and you want to get home, but you got 5 minutes. You start listening to that person, and that person tells you about a specific problem, you are into a legal contract. And you are obliged legally to help that person. Now, that person may not know it. Now you know. Sorry, I had to tell you about it. When a person does come to you with a problem, the contract does not necessarily say that it depends upon that person and what that person wants. You are the one in charge of the contract. When you listen to a person, let's say for the first hour, for the first 15 minutes or whatever it is, when you listen to a person, you do not ever promise that person that you will help that person with the problem when the person comes to you. You promise that you are willing to listen to the person and to evaluate whether you may be the best person to help. What you are promising when a person comes to you with a problem is an assessment. Then you are legally obliged only to assess the problem. Now, I'm not saying that you talk legal language to these people. I want you to know, though, what's happening, okay? Now, once you agree to help a person with a problem, you are legally obliged. But to help a person with a problem does not necessarily mean that you have to be the primary helper, or what might be called the primary therapist. If someone comes to me as pastor, and because of limitations of time, because of limitations of expertise in dealing with that kind of a problem, whatever my limitations may be, and maybe I just don't want to help the person, doesn't mean I'm legally obliged then to meet with that person all the time, but it means that I am legally obliged to see that that person gets help for his or her problem. That may be referral to someone else. That is helping the person. And that is my legal obligation, to see that the person gets the kind of help that he or she needs. When you are doing an assessment, an evaluation, you are doing it technically as a duly responsible member of your profession. Which means, don't diagnose what you're not trained to diagnose. Let me give you an example. We can talk about this one a little later, too. Let's say a woman comes into your office and says, "My husband is an alcoholic, and I just get so damn sick and tired of him. I don't want to live with him, because every time I just walk into that house, my stomach just gets tight." You might think to yourself, "Stomach's getting tight, psychosomatic problem." Because you do not have a medical license, you can never assume that a somatic complaint is psychosomatic. You are legally obliged to refer that person to a doctor, to an MD. Because if you make any decision about a physical complaint, you are not practicing your profession, you're practicing the medical profession. So whenever you make an evaluation or an assessment of anything, practice only your profession. If you do not refer that person to the person of the helping profession that can benefit that person the most, you can be guilty of abandoning the client. So once you decide you're going to help a person, what it's saying is you have to follow through as best as you can as a member of the clergy profession to see that that person gets the help that he or she needs. Okay? Now, duration of a contract can be almost anything. It can be limited in the sense that you might say to a person, well, let's talk about this, let's say 1 hour a week for 4 weeks, and at the end of that time, we'll evaluate as to whether we should go on and I can help you or someone else can help you a little better. That's what's called a limited contract. Or a contract can be indefinite. The person has to know what the contract is and how you see the relationship in the contract. You are obliged to tell the person for what you are treating him or her. You have to let the person know what the foreseeable benefits of counseling might be, as well as what the foreseeable risks of counseling might be. You're not obliged to give inappropriate treatment that you don't think you can give or you don't think is good for a person. For example, the whole abortion issue. Let's say someone comes in to you and says, here's my daughter, she's pregnant, she needs an abortion. It's because of our theological stance, we do not believe that abortion is appropriate treatment, we are not obliged to give that treatment or to refer that person for an abortion, okay? So your theological stance does have something to do with it. But you have to state that to the person. You have to let them be clear as to what kind of help you can give and what kind of help you cannot give. By telling people about foreseeable benefits and risks, for example, let's say that a parent comes to you, let's say a family comes to you, and it's obvious to you that with this 16-year-old kid, the parents are just, you know, sloppily overprotective. And now this person, 16 years old, wants to go out to the show or, you know, across the street or something ridiculous that most 16-year-olds, most 8-year-olds do anyway. And what you are obliged to do in this case is say, I'm willing to counsel with you, but a foreseeable risk is, from the parent's point of view, that the child may become more independent. Because only adults, not minors, only adults can consent, have the capacity to consent under the law. Only an adult can determine for a minor what can be done as far as the child is concerned, regardless of what you think may be best or anything like that. A minor cannot consent. There are other risks that you have to let minors know about. What would you do? Let me give you an example. Let's say Wednesday afternoon at 2 o'clock, 15-year-old girl comes into your office, and she says, Pastor, I want to talk with you about something. What would you do? She's 16 years old, or 15 years old. It means, according to the law, she has to be in school and it's during school hours. Would you be contributing to a state of defense if you saw her at that hour? If you saw her without her parents' consent, would you be contributing to the offense of separation from the family or alienation of affection? Regardless of what you think is best. Let's say she's pregnant and you know her parents are going to knock her out of the house when she gets home. The point is here that you have to decide what your priorities are. And I can't answer that question for you. You know, personally, I'd help the girl and I'd see her. But I have to be aware of what my risks are in doing that, and that I can be sued. And if I'm aware of that, it is not malpractice or negligence, that is a deliberate criminal offense. I'm not saying these happen every day, but I want you to know what the law is, okay?
Everybody's going, I'll be afraid to relate to anyone now.
Okay, when you're working with adults, you must have the individual consent of each adult with whom you are working. If it's marriage counseling, husband and wife, if it's family counseling, and there's an older parent, let's say you have adult children, and they're talking with you concerning putting one of the adult children's parents in a nursing home, something like that. You cannot talk about that person without that person's consent unless the court has taken away that person's capacity to consent and given guardianship to one of the adult children. Okay? So, just want you to know. All right, another double bind. When these are, yeah.
Can you clarify that? Do you mean that if a husband or a wife comes in to you on top of the marriage,
no, you have to have the consent of all people with whom you are working.
Okay, so you can still work with that.
Yeah.
How would you work with people without?
Well, okay, it happens more in family practice. Let's say grandma comes in with them, or you go to a home, and they say, Pastor, we want to discuss with you what to do with grandma. And there's grandma who cannot hear, who cannot see, but they have not gone through the court procedure of getting guardianship for her. You don't have her consent to make a to help them make a decision concerning her. Well, under most circumstances, you talk about her anyway, and you talk about the decision, but what I'm saying is you're not legally clean and you're not covering yourself. If they decide to put her in a nursing home and another child or someone else gets a lawyer, they can sue you for contribution. Yeah. You work with the one who's there. You don't have to have the consent of the other person. You know, 50% of the time that's the way it happens anyway, one person comes in. Yeah. Now, you can talk about a relationship with the other person. I'll say something about what you pick up and what you put down about the other person. I'll get their notes. Okay. You've always heard never say never. Got one exception. Never make a promise that you will never disclose information. Because you can get caught in a double legal bind. Because you are not covered by privileged communication, the court has a right to subpoena from you information. Subpoena is a writ by the court. A subpoena for information or records is called a subpoena ducis tecum. They can also ask you for a deposition, which means that you go in and testify under oath. Okay, so you're caught that way. They have the right to ask any information you may get. Anyone has a right to subpoena someone else. That's why one thing is, always have a lawyer, never answer a subpoena right away. Always get your lawyer to do it for you because lawyers can quash most subpoenas. For example, you know the Eagleton case that was up today? All right. You know that any one of us in this room has the legal right to subpoena anyone to appear in court for that case. Now let's say that you're a pastor and you get a subpoena. You've got to find out who that subpoena comes from and why they're there. If you show up, you've had it. Get your lawyer to find out who filed the subpoena and what the information is that they want from you. Don't just answer subpoenas because it looks official all the time. Find a lawyer and use a lawyer. Yeah.
You are in a counseling relationship with someone, and you receive a legal
that's the other side of the legal bind I was going to mention, because the law at the same time imposes on you what is technically called an implied warranty of confidentiality. They got you both ways now. Right. Yeah. Now, when they're talking about implied warranty of confidentiality, what is considered as appropriate sharing of confidential information is sharing with other professionals. This happens, for example, on our staff all the time when we have case conferences, or when you're getting consultation from another person or for a supervisor. That is not breach of confidence. But you can be sued for breach of contract if it is not stated that you are not covered. Now, I do want to say this. I have never mentioned to a person that I'm not covered by privileged communication. It's a risk you have to take. Because if you have a paranoid person, you're not going to be able to help that person. You tell them. Right. Uh-huh. This is where we have to use our own judgment and be willing to take the risk. No, okay. First of all, here, yeah, but that person would never lose, win a lawsuit, first of all. You know, first come in, I just shot somebody, you don't say, well, let's sit down and talk about it, you know. Where is the person, you know? Where's the ambulance? Okay, let me give you a couple instances where I've had to make decisions like that. I didn't mention it. After three groups, you don't know, and you're doing the same thing three times the same night, you don't know what you said in one group and what you haven't said. When I was a pastor down at Concordia Maplewood here, it happened right in this area, within a mile of them here. I'd been visiting this lady and her son, the lady's husband had died, and I'd been visiting them a couple months. One day I walked into their house, it was a second floor flat, and the most god-awful smell you just couldn't imagine. It smells a little bit in here today, doesn't it? And, that's nothing. Oh, well, what's going on? And walked in to sit down, and it just got so unbearable. And, I was starting to get sick. So I just walked back. I got to see what this smell is. I walked back. I opened the back door, and there was this old lady in her 80s, about 60, 70 pounds. She's a diabetic, and she had a gangrenous leg that just stunk all over. And this lady says, well, God says this time we're just going to let Mother die. And she's not feeling any pain, and she showed me that they pumped down a couple fifths of booze in her, so she didn't feel any pain, and didn't know what was happening. Well, I went over to the phone to call the police, and this lady just became absolutely hysterical, and she came with me, and I just went like that and shoved her across the room, and I called the police. Now, needless to say, they were no longer members of the congregation, but I feel I made the right decision. The lady died within a couple of weeks anyway, but, you know, those are those things that you have to do. You don't think through all the legal implications of it. Talk about shaking like a leaf. You know, here's Carl trying to be calm. You know, I know what I'm doing. You know, I don't think I don't know how I drove home. But you know, things like that are going to happen. Had another instance in having to take someone from the congregation to court. A woman's boyfriend took a less than 1 year old child. Just took the child by the ankles and gave him what's known as a spiral syndrome. Just like that, and the bone splintered up the legs all the way. The child's still crippled. That was 15, 16 years ago at that time. You have a number of values as a Christian, and you may have conflicting legal values, but And all your values can be good, but it's sometimes you're going to have to give one more priority than the other. And life to me is a priority, and I'll worry about the legal consequences later. And I don't know that anybody could ever win a lawsuit against you if you went on that, because, again, going back to being a pastor, you're acting as a duly recognized member of your profession and what you would do in that instance with your values. So if that's any comfort, you know, if you follow your values, if you follow Christian love, then what's the... I don't mean to imply situation ethics, but situations call for different priorities of values at different times. And I don't think you're going to get into trouble following those values. Does that answer the concern you were addressing? No, but it was an interesting story. Go on. Yeah, what's your concern? No. Yeah. Not unless you were complying in a criminal offense, you don't have to defend yourself with the Fifth Amendment.
Like if you said something, then you incriminate yourself
to the charge of breaking. But if that has nothing to do with the case at hand, it doesn't apply. That would be a case against you that the person they bring has nothing to do with the case that's in court at the time. It's not complicity with that act. So you're not covered. Okay, a couple other things. If you do want to get consultation on a regular basis from another professional, always ask for a signed release of information that the person is aware, saying that the person is aware that you are sharing information germane to helping with this instance with another professional. And you state who the professional or the agency or whatever it is that you're using for consultation or referral. Okay, just a couple other things, then we'll get to the questions. Malpractice is negligent wrongdoing. This means you're not aware that you're doing it. If you're aware that you're doing it, it's not malpractice, it's a criminal act, and nothing's going to protect you from that. I really can't see in this day any reason, though, why a pastor should not be covered by malpractice insurance. And I think it's necessary. If you're doing counseling with people in your congregation or people in your community, the congregation should take out malpractice insurance on you and on themselves. Because even if somebody sues you, you most likely don't have enough money that they're not going to get anything anyway, so they're going to go after the church building. So it's only fair to your congregation that since they are hiring you to represent them in the community, they can also be sued, and they should cover themselves. And it's a very small fee. Generally, malpractice insurance for pastor is less than $100 a year. So, yeah. Yes, the LCA is the only church body that has it for all of the pastors. In Missouri Synod, you kind of have to ask around. If anybody's interested, you can get in touch with me at the office. If you live in Missouri, I can give you places. But best thing to do when you get wherever you're going to be is check it out with psychologists in private practice and social workers, and they'll know where it's available. Yeah. That's right, because people don't like to write it. For example, in the reason, let me give you an example of what happens in Missouri. They do not recognize clergy profession as a counseling profession, but there's a loophole in the state law that recognizes clergy who counsel as psychologists, so you are a psychologist under malpractice insurance. There are ways around, but that's why you have to find out in the state where you go. No, some write it. And, Yeah, it's around and it's not that expensive, but in different states you have to technically be covered in different ways under different titles. Okay, generally, to avoid malpractice, always be sure that you verify all facts. Someone comes into you and says, my next door neighbor is beating his wife. Don't assume that the next door neighbor is beating his wife. All you know is that this person perceives that the next door neighbor is beating his wife. Never write anything down to that effect. It can never be harmful to a person in records unless it's a verified fact. And then if it can be harmful to the person and not beneficial to the life of another person, don't write it down. I'll say a little something about what should be kept in records. Follow through with all appointments. People are very dependent on pastors. Some people who may be suicidal and you may not know that they are suicidal live from week to week to see you, and that's the only thing that's keeping them alive. You say that you're going to see them at 7:30 and you don't show up at 7:30, that can technically be abandonment of client. There are instances when you're going to be called out on emergency and can't see them, so you have to cover yourself. Never write an appointment in your book without knowing that person's phone number, especially if it's another person from outside the congregation. Where can I get a hold of you an hour or 2 hours before our appointment time if I cannot make it? And then you are obliged to call that person and to set up another appointment. Same thing if you're going on vacation. Separation and termination. You have to cover these things. If you're going on vacation and a person has had heavy depressive episodes, let's say, while I'm gone, here's Pastor So-and-so's name, and let Pastor So-and-so know that this person may call, or some other professional counselor in the community. But you got to cover it. Follow through. If a person misses an appointment, since you agreed to hear that person's problem, you are legally obliged to follow through, even if the person misses the appointment. Say, I missed you. You know, what happened? Respond to all phone calls. If you do not respond, document in writing why you did not respond. I'll give you an example of this. You're doing marriage counseling with two people, and they really have knockdown dragouts when you're counseling with them. And one wants to call up and bend your ear on the phone. And you tell that person when he or she calls on the phone, I don't think it's appropriate for me to talk to you on the phone since we're in marriage counseling. And since you're in marriage counseling together, we'll see you at the time that we set up. That person keeps calling you and pestering you. Write down in your records, I did not call this person back on such and such a date when he or she called because I did not want this person to manipulate me or pester me anymore. You got to cover yourself. Okay, practice only your profession, the somatic complaint thing that we talked about before. Did I mention that? Okay, a couple things concerning records. The less recorded, the better. Tell you what we do with records in our agency. We have only a couple categories. No more than one sheet on a case. What the complaint is, or the problem, or whatever you want to call it. Well, how's the person come into you? And put everything there in quotation marks or cited as coming from the person. What's the problem? We're having marriage problems concerning so-and-so, our sex life, whatever it may be, okay? Second, your impression, this is if you keep records, these are the things you should keep, your impression concerning that person's problem, not diagnosis, only your impression, because then you can say, these are my impressions and you're not claiming to practice a profession for which you're not trained. I agree that these people are having problems in their marriage. That's your impression. But don't state in your own words that these people have a horrible sex life or whatever the problem is, okay? It's just your impression of yourself. Third, your plan of action. I agreed to meet with these people for four times and assess, and we're going to work on such and such a problem. If they mention problems up here that you agreed not to work on, also state what you agreed not to work on and why you're not working on that.
because the person has an ingrown toenail and I'm not a podiatrist, or, you know, something like that. Fourth category is evaluation. At the end of, this can be done periodically or at the end. Did the client or parishioner think that it was beneficial? Did I think that I helped them to the best of my ability? And last, termination notes. We agreed that this family ought to see a social worker, or maybe ought to have tests for the kid from a clinical psychologist, or ought to go through an MD, or the problem seems fine now, and we're open to them coming back to us if they feel the need. That's it. Never anything else in the record about a person. Now, let's say that you're doing supervision. How many of you have CPE? Any? Or ever have to write verbatims on hospital calls or anything like that? Okay, maybe it's coming. If you want to keep notes as to what happened, because you're seeing so many people and you're not sure, like Dell would have another file entitled Dell's Process Notes concerning this type of situation. It is against the law in any one office to have two files with the same title or the same name on. This goes for personnel records in Monsanto, anywhere, when you're talking about a hospital or anywhere. You can never have a dual file system. So one is that person's file, and this is your file on process notes concerning certain situations of relationships with people, not concerning people, concerning relationships with people, so that by using these notes, either for supervision or consultation, you can become a better pastor. Got that? Wish these things weren't all recorded. Okay, now for the real. Okay, no, that's important though. You can never keep a dual file system. It's against the law. Okay, a couple other quickies. How pastors' wives are involved in the whole confidentiality issue. Because if Dell's out with the scouts over a weekend, which he chickened out on this weekend, and Judy is at home and someone from the parish calls and says, Pastor Nackin? No, he isn't. And the person starts to go on and on. Well, I got this problem. And pretty soon Judy's listening to him for a half hour or an hour or so. Who's the counselor in that situation? Judy is not the counselor. But if Dell is the recognized counselor, and she has, and he's already met with her, you're just a friend. And you can listen to a friend, because just don't promise them you're going to help them. but if it's someone and say, well, you know, pastor told me to go out and do this, but I couldn't do it for these reasons, and that person involves you in the case, then you are privy to the information, and you have to keep that confidential. Now, what about all these things that just are not confidential, that most spouses know what the other spouses are doing? You know, especially in a small congregation, if people are going to meet with you in the evening for counseling, and your wife certainly knows who you're meeting with, right? And let's say they're people who are real problems. That information is going to get through by osmosis anyway. You come home nervous, you come home upset, or you come home disappointed because people have decided to get a divorce. And wife says, well, honey, how'd everything go? Fine, honey, nothing's bothering me. You go in the other room and cry, or you bust one of the kids' toys or whatever may be around. Okay. You know, somehow or another, even if names are not mentioned, and usually names are known, the feelings about the case are known, so the spouse is always going to know something about what's going on. This is unavoidable. It's considered part of confidentiality that you do not tell your spouse. But see, confidentiality laws were written for people who see 10 clients a day. And if I'm sitting in an office downtown seeing 10 clients a day, it's altogether different from when I'm in a parish and my wife may know the same people. Now, it's never been brought to court, anything. But I just want you to know that my guess is that if it were, the same laws would apply to the wife as to the husband. Because the pastoral profession is different from other counseling professions. And you cannot help but be involved in the ministry of your spouse. And my guess is that you can get around it on that. The thing is, you have to be very careful about what information you share about some people without other people, with other people. What do you do if you're the wife in the situation, and somebody comes up to you and, well, saw your husband the other night. Now, if you know that they saw your husband, what are you going to say? Yeah, I know. Boy, you got a problem, don't you, folks? No, no, that's okay. Oh, what are you going to say? Oh, you did? And you may have known anyway. You're supposed to act surprised. What are you supposed to do? All you can do is say, you know, I'm glad. Or, you know, maybe I'm sad. Oh, you did. It's just about the best response. You know. So people don't get the idea that everything being discussed. Now, I also want you to know that, you know, I went through many years trying to be a shrink, and my wife is a much better shrink than I am by intuition. And I think she's helped me an awful lot. And that's gonna, even my feelings about the case, even if you're not discussing a case, you know, part of what you're doing in counseling is determined by your feelings about the case. Yeah. Don't ever promise that you'll cure them. I didn't say, you know, you can promise that you'll help them to the extent that you're able. You are not responsible for the perception another person has if you inform them as a duly recognized member of your profession. Okay, that's what a lawyer would say. Now let me tell you what that means. That if a person says, will you help me? And you say, yeah, let's see what we can do about this. And, or you can, or let's say, if you can give me, will you help me get my mother in a nursing home? Well, first of all, you don't know that that's the best thing for the mother at that time. All you promise is that you're going to make an assessment. Well, let's sit down and talk about it and see what the options are or the possibilities are. As things become clear and the process develops, you can promise what you're able to do. Just don't promise what you're not able to do. Yeah. None that I know of. Oh, I know there are pastors taking the court. I, you know, because our lawyer gives us all the court cases on those. I don't know that they're strictly LCMS. And if there are Lutherans, they're identified usually as Lutherans and not necessarily by LCMS. And, it's necessary to remember too that most of the cases where pastors have been to court have been won by the pastors. So, you know, anybody can take anybody to court nowadays. So that really doesn't mean a thing. Yeah, here I go scaring again, and I really don't mean to. Just want you to be aware of what's going on. I don't know how many times I can say that. You know, I've never been taken to court. No one in our agency has ever been taken to court. We've had information, well, we have professional counselors, and we cover ourselves legally, though. But and it's never hurt a counseling relationship, because what it does is tell the person who's coming to you for counseling, you know, I know what my profession entails, and I'm a responsible member of my profession. Now, you don't talk in legal terms. When you're talking about confidentiality, you say, yes, of course I'll keep this confidential. The only instance in which I couldn't keep it confidential, let's say in a marriage counseling, is if one of you were to subpoena me as a witness for or against the other. So whether the confidentiality is breached is really up to you. One other little quickie. Whenever a pastor is meeting with a single woman, always have somebody else in the building. That's it. If somebody wants to stay, I know time is up. I want to answer the question about the living together that you asked. I got the last page of my notes now. See, after being through them three times, I didn't have to flip all the pages, and I didn't see where I had written it down. Generally, in the question of living together, if the two persons who are living together are adults, according to law, there's nothing you can do about it. Let me put the same law in a different framework that will explain it to you. In the state of Missouri, only a pregnant woman has the right to say what will happen to her child, whether it will go up for adoption, whether she'll keep it or not. Let's say you got a 13-year-old girl. The parents, what the parents have to say have absolutely no bearing on whether the girl keeps the child, gives it up for adoption, gets an abortion or whatever, legally, okay? Now, the parents do have a legal right to say, if you keep that child, I will not allow you in my home. The only legal rights the parents have is to kick someone out of the home if the persons are adults. And if anyone 8 years old has a child, by reason of having a child, that person is an adult under the law in the state of Missouri, not in all states.
An adult in what respect?
An adult has the right to consent and to make contracts.
In all respects, they are considered adults?
No, concerning the child. Can't buy a house.
Child.
Yeah, can't buy a house, can't sign a mortgage or anything like that. Yeah. But the decision concerning the child, yeah.